Hello, everyone. This is Sean Ennis with the MMA Torchcast for Thursday, March 6, 2008. And joining me this week, we have a new co-host for now. His name is John Taylor. John, how are you?
Doing well. How are you doing, Sean?
I am excellent. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, good. Well, let's get started right, and then we'll throw it to you real quick. Do a quick intro. Tell us where a little bit about yourself and what brings you to the Torch, that kind of stuff.
For sure. Well, my name is John Taylor, as you mentioned, and I was a Torch columnist for just about a year, about 6 months back, and then I just recently got back into the mix. The Torch, you know, had a redesign, and I think a lot of the changes have been real positive. But, yeah, I mean, I've been on and off doing freelance work for different sites for the past few years, and just recently got into managing MMA fighters. I have my own management company, which is Devastation Company in Sacramento, California. And I got a couple of fighters upcoming on some local cards, and just trying to make it blow up and go nationwide. So that's my background. And other than that, I'm just a fan, really. So
excellent, excellent. Well, good to have you aboard. Thanks for doing the show tonight.
Absolutely, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and well, let's just get started and jump right into it here. We'll take a look back at last weekend. We started off. We've had, there's been three semi-significant to significant events since last weekend. We had the IFL card on Friday, then, of course, UFC 82 Saturday, and then earlier today there was the World Victory Road show in Japan, which I haven't seen anywhere how you can actually see that show. Have you seen anything on that?
Yeah, I've been trying to go the alternate routes, which is basically some websites trying to catch clips here and there. But
sure.
Honestly, I haven't seen a bunch on it. There's no way, at least in my area, where we could get the event. So I think right now, World Victory Road's pretty sparse here in the States. So
yeah, that's the impression I'm getting as well. Well, with the IFL event that we mentioned first, that was Friday, as we said, broadcast on HDNet. I did catch the card. I know you didn't have a chance to see it, but you didn't miss much, quite honestly. It wasn't too much to it. Matt Horwich lost his title in a pretty lackluster affair. Schultz.
Yeah.
Ryan Schultz
held
on his. Yeah, Ryan McGivern's the guy that won from Horwich, and then Ryan Schultz held on to his title, and Roy Nelson, I believe, hung on to his as well with a knockout. Other than that, you know, it was what it was. Not great, but not horrible either. Certainly not as bad as the Strikeforce card the week before, but you know, what are you going
to
do?
That'd be pretty hard to to bottom out on that one. But I mean,
they can't all be winners, I guess.
Yikes! Yeah, I've seen some backyard wrestling that was better than that Strikeforce card. So can't win them all.
Pretty
right?
Bad. That's very true. But then we had, of course, we had UFC 82 on Saturday night. And we'll do a quick rundown of that card.
Sure.
Let's start with the main event with Anderson Silva and Dan Henderson. Now, there's been a lot made of, you know, obviously Anderson Silva being the pound-for-pound top fighter in the world. I said it myself in my coverage. What's your take on Silva? What's your take on this fight? And where do Silva and Henderson go from here?
Well, those are good questions. I mean, Silva, until somebody beats him, or at least even takes him into the third round, it's hard to argue that he's the top pound for pound. I mean, the only reason I would put him above Fedor is because, you know, Fedor really hasn't fought anybody of significance since he fought New Year's Eve of 05 against Krokop. So, I mean, that's a good long time to not fight top competition. When you look at Anderson Silva, he's gone on a tear against the very best that the UFC has to offer. I mean, I think a lot of Matt Lindland fans would disagree that he's fought the very best, because Matt Lindland's definitely got to be in the conversation, and Dana White definitely doesn't seem to want Matt Lindland in the conversation. But, I mean, beating Rich twice, the way he handled Dan Henderson, even though I thought Henderson had a good first round, he's been pretty unstoppable. I mean, his toughest fight, which is kind of weird, has been the Luter fight. And I think people would think that out of the names he's beaten, that would have probably been the one that would have given him the least amount of trouble. But, yeah, I mean, there's no arguing with Silva right now. I mean, in my view, he's the top pound for pound. And I think, honestly, in the majority of people's view at this point, he is.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on that. I think, you know, with the Luter fight, I watched that again recently, and you did hear Joe Rogan talking later after that fight about the knee surgeries, and I don't know if that was ever actually confirmed. I don't think it's the kind of thing that Silva would actually talk about, you know, especially seeing as how he won the fight. There's no reason for him to really even bring it up.
Yeah.
But given all that, you know, just the fact that he won that fight after, you know, being taken down and all that kind of stuff, and then just getting Luter in the triangle, and you know, I thought that was, you know, even though Luter wasn't the top flight competition that Dan Henderson is, being in trouble and then getting out of it and winning the fight in dominant fashion again, I thought was even impressive.
That brings up a good point. I think that just adds to kind of the legacy he's building.
Yeah,
is that the one fight he's really shown vulnerability. He was in trouble. I mean, if you watch that fight again, Luter had full mount and was raining down some shots. I mean, it was a good five or six shots away from being stopped, if you ask me. And the way he swept and reversed positions on him and finished that fight, I mean, I think you're right. I think it adds to kind of the legacy he's building, that he's not just a mow you down, but you can hurt him and he'll come back, so...
Yeah,
and I think he actually showed that in the Henderson fight a little bit. And the first
round, I was just going to get to that too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first round definitely went Henderson's way. And I think a lot of people said, okay, it looks like he's going to let Henderson pass when he gets him on the ground. And I thought it was just even more impressive how Anderson Silva handled himself in that second round.
Yeah, the really impressive thing about Silva has been his ability to adapt, I think, within a very short amount of time, because Henderson had him down, you know, was raining those hammer fists on his head. And Silva, you know, for one thing, never even seemed hurt, never even flinched, you know, at those shots. And they were hitting him right in the temple. You know, never even got cut, really.
I don't think I've ever seen him hurt by a punch.
No.
Which is amazing. I mean, he's been hit with shots, and he just goes right through him. That's one of the more amazing things about him that doesn't get talked about much, is that the guy has a really good chin.
Yeah, and it's scary for guys, you know, that are going to fight him, because you've got, you know, the next contender for Silva is probably going to be Yushin Okami, I would think.
Yeah.
And, you know, aside from this knockout that he had against Evan Tanner that night, I don't think we've seen a lot of strikes out of Okami that really have done a ton of damage on anybody.
No, I mean, when you think of Okami, you really think of his strength. He just physically, you know, manhandles people. And I wouldn't be surprised if he came to that fight and went with that approach with Silva. But I think Silva, his ground game's so underrated. I think he has a really active guard. And,
I think that
plays right into kind of Anderson Silva's strengths. Because if you try to stand with him, Silva's going to pick you apart there. And if you take him down, he's going to use that active guard to get a submission. So I don't see Okami as being much of a challenge to the reign of Anderson Silva. Yeah, I don't see it, but...
Yeah, I agree. I agree as well. I think he doesn't really have much for Silva at this point. Now you mentioned Matt Lindland before.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take? What will be your take on the Lindland-Silva fight?
I still seem to think Silva's would beat Matt Lindland. I mean, I see that fight going kind of similar to the way the Dan Henderson fight went. I think Silva has shown that he'll let you take him down. And he'll even let you pass in some situations. But can you finish him there? I don't know. And, I mean, honestly, Matt Lindland, I mean, there's going to be a degree of rust. The last time he fought was against Fedor 10 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if they were to fight tomorrow, I'd say Silva would win. Now, if Matt Lindland, you know, reels off a couple of victories with this, you know, mystery organization that, from what I understand, is going to be kind of a co-op between Affliction and Golden Boy Productions, which is Oscar De La Hoya's company. If he reels off some victories against significant competition there, and when I say I'm skeptical, it's because who are they going to have him fight? I mean, what top middleweight isn't already signed by a major organization?
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, maybe the Phil Baronis of the world or someone else.
Right.
I mean, but that's just... it's not going to be up to the caliber that the UFC has currently. So,
yeah, I agree, and I also see Silva winning a fight with Lindland. I just don't think anyone really at 185 has anything for Silva now, because you've got your Hendersons and your Lindlands who are kind of the bruisers. You know, they he'll take you down and pound on you. But, I mean, you saw with Henderson, like we already said, he couldn't hurt him on the ground.
Exactly.
Couldn't get in a position where he was able to throw effective strikes on the ground. And, you know, Henderson's a good wrestler. And Silva never, you know, he never cracked. And I just don't think Lindland has anything more than Henderson had.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you. I think Henderson's strength is wrestling, and that's Lindland's strength as well. But I think Henderson's a better striker, you know, than Lindland ever could dream of being. So
absolutely.
I think Henderson's probably a superior fighter at this point. And
I think the disadvantage for a Matt Lindland would be that he has no way of stopping Anderson Silva, and you're not taking Silva to a decision, you know, because every round starts standing up, you know, and he can stuff a takedown.
Yeah.
So, you know, all he has to do is catch you with one strike, and it's the beginning of the end. It's like he's shown time and time again, if he hits you and he hurts you, you're done.
Sooner or later, he's going to get you.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, he's the most dominant fighter in the world at this point, in my eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the card in other spots. We had actually probably one of the better fights that I thought they showed on the telecast was the Koscheck Hazel fight. I thought that was a real good fight, and Hazel really, you know, I had seen his fights in the UFC before, but I didn't remember much about him. But he really put in a good showing in this one.
Yeah, I thought his first round was excellent. I thought he did exactly what I think Koscheck thought that his stand up was a lot better than it actually is, and I thought Hazlett came out and really showed him that. I thought that I had Hazlett easily winning the first round, just basically showing improved striking over the last couple of times I've seen him. I don't think Koscheck was ready for that. He's a lot quicker, seemed a lot sharper with his strikes, and I think it threw Koscheck off a little bit.
Yeah, I think the thing about Koscheck with his striking is that he's got those shots that he throws that are really hard shots, but they're always very wild, and they're always pretty predictable too. You know, I mean, you know when he's coming and what he's coming with.
Yeah,
big haymaker and.
Yeah, he loves his overhand right, and he gets he gets addicted to it. He throws it a lot. And like you said, it's very wild, and it is. It's a classic haymaker.
Yeah. But, real good fight, and actually impressive knockout by Koscheck, too. That kick was perfect, pretty much, that ended up putting Hazel out.
If someone would have told me he'd win a fight that way 3 years ago, I would have never believed it. So that just shows how he's evolved as a fighter himself, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hazlett now, I think, is a guy to watch out for in the welterweight division. You know, and to me, a guy like that, I wouldn't mind seeing him in the WEC for a little while.
Yeah, I think that'd be perfect for him. I think a lot of these, I mean, the kid's 21.
Yeah.
You know, he's a younger guy, and, I mean, he's going to only get better. Yeah, I think you throw him in the 170 class down in the WEC, you're going to see somebody that could actually maybe give Carlos Condit some problems. And,
exactly.
At this point, I think they're looking for opponents for Condit, and I think Zuffa might have some. They're just in the UFC.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah, instead of letting Dustin Hazlett be fodder for the top 10 in the UFC, let him kind of get some seasoning and some recognition in the WEC. And I think, honestly, the WEC is misused a lot of the times with some of the fighters that they have. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd love to see 135-pound and 145-pound weight class in the UFC. I think you got Uriah Faber and Mikel Torres who are going to bring people to fights. I think those are two guys that just the next 5 years you're going to enjoy quality fights from those guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they got to keep your eye at 145 because he's just going to be too small for the 155ers, I think. But.
Yeah, well, and he showed that when he fought Tyson Griffin. I mean, they did fight at 145 when he fought Griffin, but, you know, Griffin just had too much size on him even at 145 because he was so much bigger.
Yeah, he's huge anyway. He's a huge 155er. So,
yeah.
Just to think about him at 145 is mind-blowing.
Seriously.
And that's it with Uriah. He's fought really one person that is just a legit 155er that fought at 145, and that's Griffin, and he beat him. You know, so, I mean, I don't have much – I think Uriah could get past some of the lower-level 155ers that the UFC would offer. But I think with the Clay Guidas and the Roger Huertas, and when you get to some of the mid to the upper tier guys, they would give Uriah a lot of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit it on the head, though, with him and Miguel Torres. I think a lot of people don't realize how impressive that victory was for Miguel Torres over Chase Beebe. I mean, you've got Chase Beebe, who defended at least 50 or 60 submissions against Hani Yaya in that fight that they had.
World-class Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, his submission defense is ridiculous. And Torres, you know, just took him out like it was nothing.
Yeah, I became an instant fan of that guy, I think probably 2 minutes into that fight. When they got on the ground and he started transitioning from submission attempt until he got one that worked, I was like, I'll forever be a fan of Miguel Torres. He can go on to lose 10 straight, and I'll always remember that performance against Chase Beebe. So.
Yeah, really, really good fight. But anyway, back to the to UFC 82.
Sorry, tangent there.
Yeah, it's all good. We also had Heath Herring and Chet Congo. What'd you make of this one? Kind of an interesting
fight.
Well,
it went exactly how I didn't think it was going to go.
Yeah.
I had a complete vision in my head of how that fight would go. I thought Congo would definitely try to keep it standing, and I think Heath Herring, with his improved striking via the training from Rob Kamen, I thought that they would try to slug it out. I was very surprised when Congo seemed interested in having a ground fight. I thought that was a little bit of an odd choice. He held his own in the first round, but Herring has just showed that he's a little bit stronger maybe than Congo and a little bit craftier. And I think that if you're going to put those guys in a Muay Thai fight, Congo's going to win 99 out of 100 times. But Herring kind of manipulate you on the ground a little bit, he's just going to lay and pound and hammer one out. And I think it definitely takes a little bit of the shine off of Chet Congo. But, you know, this fight really did nothing for me as far as Heath Herring goes. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's the same Heath Herring I've ever seen. He just happened to get a win against Chet Congo by doing
I definitely thought this was the best that we'd seen Herring in the UFC anyway.
Easily.
Which, you know,
without
saying much. But,
no, it's not. I mean, I would have disagreed if he would have jumped on a Big Nog and finished that fight like he should have.
Right.
That would have been the best Heath Herring I ever saw, but then the lackluster two rounds in there. And I mean, believe me, I mean, I'm not trying to take anything away from Heath Herring. I just, I don't know if he's going to be. Well, first off, I never think he'll be Big Nog. I think his best opportunity was in that first round of their last fight. And to be honest, I don't know if anyone wants to see them fight for a fourth time. So,
I don't.
Yeah, personally, it's not an appealing fight to me. So, you know, Heath Herring's one of those guys that I think's in heavyweight purgatory right now because I don't think they're going to throw him a title shot with this victory. And I think they would have considered giving Congo if he would have won. I think he would have been one of the next guys in line. So that heavyweight division in the UFC is as deep as it's ever been, but it's still just muddled with uncertainty.
Yeah,
I mean, you got Dana White still talking about giving Randy Couture fights.
Yeah.
I was like, you just sued him, so I don't know why you're going to want him to fight for you, but it's just an odd situation. So,
Who, in your estimation, is the number one contender for the to Big Nog right now?
That's a good question. Yeah, who is it? I mean, I would be tempted to say. I mean, I'm tempted to say Herring, even though I don't want to. You know, it's a fight. It's a fight I don't want to see. But at the same time, it's who else is there? I mean, you got Brandon Vera coming off the loss to Tim Sylvia. I think he's desirable, and I think he'd be a really desirable light heavyweight. For some reason, he doesn't want to get that through his head. You got Congo, who just lost. Krokov, who decided he doesn't want to fight in a cage, so he took off.
Yeah.
You know, you still got Fabricio Werdum, who I guess would be, he and Herring would be probably the choices. And, I mean, I guess out of those choices, I'd take Fabricio Werdum just because I haven't seen him fight four times against Big Nog.
Yeah. Well, you know, to me, it's Arlovsky. I mean, Arlovsky, I know, just had the last fight in his contract. But, I mean, he's the only guy right now who's won, you know, three fights in a row.
If you told me that Arlovsky was fighting Big Nog tomorrow, I would pay any amount of money to see it.
I think that's a great fight. Yeah.
However, Dana White for whatever reason, sees differently. I mean, they didn't even give Arlovski a post-fight interview. I mean, that's how dismissive and indifferent Dana White is currently to Andrei Arlovski, who, and you're right, he's probably the second best heavyweight in the UFC right now. He is, due to some lackluster performances, he's gotten the cold shoulder. You know, even though he won that fight with Werdum, somehow Werdum gets the fight with Gonzaga and now is in line to possibly get a title shot. So,
yeah, which I, for the life of me, I can't understand that.
Yeah, get a better fight. It doesn't make sense. But
yeah, I mean, to me, you know, Gonzaga was winning that fight until he gassed out, which you can say about a lot of fights, but still.
Yeah. No,
I agree. I mean, I wasn't terribly impressed with the way he beat Gonzaga.
No, and I mean, I don't know if Verdum's maybe one of those guys that's never going to really just blow your mind when he fights. I think sometimes he wins against good competition, but he's not a guy that you're like, wow, that Fabricio Werdum, that guy's the best, you know, but somehow he seems to get wins against quality opposition, and for whatever reason, he's kind of the guy that Dana's looking to instead of Arlovski, which...
Yeah, and at the moment, he's fighting Brandon Vera at some point. I can't remember exactly when they're fighting, but it's going to be one of
Now they're doing these USCs so far in advance, it's got to keep a kind of a flow chart.
Yeah, and speaking of which, not to get off topic, we'll come back to UFC 82 in a minute, but now you just mentioned that they've got these fights scheduled out in advance for a while, and we just had Chuck Liddell was scheduled to fight Shogun Hua at UFC 85 in London, which of course is three UFCs away. But now, of course, Hua has dropped out of that fight because of re-aggravating his knee injury. And the problem for the UFC, at least at the moment, is that most of their light heavyweight talent is already signed up for other fights.
It's booked.
Yeah.
It's booked themselves into a bad spot.
Yeah,
I mean, I've heard some speculation on who this person could be that fights Chuck. I've heard names like Jason Lambert, people like that. They said that maybe they would unbook either Rashad Evans or Thiago Silva for UFC 84 and try to book them for UFC 85. I know a lot of people on the internet had talked about Stefan Bonner a little bit, but he's blown out his knee. That's why he's not fighting Matt Hamill at the UFC Fight Night card, which, I mean, that's a fairly interesting fight. I mean, Bonner gets handled in that fight.
Yeah,
at least it would have piqued some fan interest a lot. But, I don't know. I don't know who they're going to book to fight Chuck. This is a quandary because every top light heavyweight is booked for a fight.
Absolutely. And
next 4 months. So
yeah, I actually mentioned Bonner myself in my blog yesterday, forgetting that he had pulled out of the fight with Hamill. But you know, to me, probably the most intriguing one under contract with the UFC anyway is Rashad Evans. But I don't know if they make that fight. You know, they would have to obviously pull away from the Thiago Silva fight, which I also think is a pretty good fight, honestly. But I don't think they'd book him against Silva because Silva has got a pretty good shot of beating Liddell, and nobody knows who he is.
Exactly. I think that would – I mean, that's a good point. That'd be suicide. Because if you win, you beat somebody that doesn't have big-name recognition.
Yeah.
But if you lose, Chuck's pretty officially washed up at that point.
Yeah.
And then at that point, it makes people start to wonder about Vanderlei Silva a little bit. Well, I guess he's done, too. He couldn't even beat Liddell. So,
yeah.
Which is weird to even think of that in that context.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, I think that's perception's reality in this business. And I think that would be in large part a perception that would come through.
Yeah. So what do they do here? Do they need to go outside the UFC to bring somebody in?
Well, it's a great idea. I mean, there's good light heavyweights out there that, as far as I know, aren't under contract. One being Ricardo Arona, which I think would be an incredibly interesting fight. Ricardo Arona obviously couldn't stand with Chuck, but if he was to somehow get him down, which seems like the biggest challenge in any fight with Chuck Liddell, I think he could really give him problems on the ground. But a lot of people have been great ground fighters, and Chuck just hasn't let the fight get to the ground. So,
that's been his MO. I mean, he's been knocking out grapplers for years.
Yeah. One possibility, I think, for Chuck's fight is one of these light heavyweights that's booked for UFC Fight Night 13, April 2nd, wins in impressive fashion and doesn't get hurt, and then they sign him up to fight in June. I mean, it's a good 2.5 months away from the April card. And on that card, you got Hamill, you got Tim Boyce, you also got Houston Alexander, and you have, to a lesser degree, James Irvin, who I like personally because he's an exciting fighter from Sacramento, which is my hometown. But at the same time, James Irvin just seems to have weird luck.
The fight with Thiago Silva, and then,
Yeah, it's like you have fights where he's falling out of the cage. You have fights where his knees are buckling. He's getting kneed in the head. His fights just end weird. So hopefully against Houston Alexander, at least have a proper finish. But yeah, I mean, there's some good 180 or 205ers on that card, which I could see possibly moving into that June spot.
Yeah, I think I think you mentioned a good possibility in the Alexander Irvin fight, because to me, that's going to be a one or two punch fight. You know, I mean, I don't see the winner of that fight taking too much damage because it's not going to go very long.
neither of those guys want to fight on the ground. So
no.
And they both just throw bombs, so I see that being a quick fight as well.
Yeah. So it's an interesting situation that they've got themselves into here. You know, personally, I'd like to see Little Nog come in here and fight Liddell.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, I think it's a great fight, but at the same time, you've still got that problem of name recognition. I mean, luckily for them now, they do have Big Nog as the heavyweight champion. They can promote it as his twin brother coming to fight Chuck, which is actually pretty intriguing, really. But
yeah, it helps. Definitely helps. I don't know what his contract status is. I think he was signed with a Canadian promotion. I don't know if that's an exclusive deal.
Hardcore Fighting Championship. Signed with up there, but I don't know if that's a per fight deal or if it's a long term thing or whatever. But you know, I mean, it happened with Sokaju where he was, you know, allegedly signed up 4 or 5 times before the UFC got him. So who knows what's going to happen with that?
Everywhere. So I think the UFC's booked themselves into a corner. They'll find somebody.
Yeah, for sure.
They'll throw some
definitely
money
no shortage of fighters.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get back to the pay-per-view here. We've got the fight, the one fight of the night here, not fight of the night, knockout of the night, Chris Leben and Alessio Sakara. Now, this, to me, was pretty much exactly the way I thought it was going
to
go. What was your take
on
this
one? it's Chris Leben. And, you know, I can't remember who said it, but it made a lot of sense, is that Chris Leben is an MMA fan's guilty pleasure.
Absolutely.
You know that there's going to be bombs thrown. You know that someone's getting hit on the chin repeatedly, and you're most likely going to see an explosive knockout. And that's exactly what happened in this fight. Alessio Sakara is a guy that has excellent stand-up skills. He just doesn't have much of a chin. And I think we saw it come to fruition again. He was hitting Leben with everything but the stool in the first couple of minutes of that fight. And tell you what, Leben seems to, unless it's Anderson Silva throwing those bombs, Leben seems to be able to take them and landed another huge shot and then followed up with some serious ground and pound. So,
yeah,
I think it pretty much went according to the script on that one, so.
Yeah, to me, you can't get a worse opponent for Alessio Sakara than Chris Leben.
It's a pretty bad one.
Yeah, because you can't hurt him. I mean, you know, like you said, this side of Anderson Silva, you can't hurt Chris Leben. You know, I mean, he fought Terry Martin for 2.5 rounds, and Terry Martin can throw some leather.
Yeah,
you know,
and Terry Martin wasn't missing most of the first two rounds of that fight. So
no, he wasn't.
And he's taken the best shots of Patrick Cote. I mean, this guy, his chin's no joke. I mean, he's got that reputation for a good reason. And even in the Silva fight, you saw him take a tremendous amount of punishment, and he still stood up just to take more shots. But, the guy, I don't know how smart he is, but he's tough. He's a tough kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was an exciting fight. I thought I probably got a bigger thrill out of that fight just for the sheer damage that was going on than any other fight that night. So,
now what's your take on Sakara now? Does he hang around the UFC? What do they do with Sakara?
That's Alessio Sakara. I mean, for the amount of hype he had coming into the UFC as being, you know, a fairly successful pro boxer, He hasn't shown much. You know, he's had a real rough go of it. He seems to do okay against the low-level talent, but the minute he fights anybody kind of in the mid-card, such as Leben, Dean Lister would be another good example.
Yeah.
He seems to have some problems. And I know this is his first shot at 185, and so I'd imagine seeing him another time at 185 just to kind of get a feel for it. But, yeah, I don't see him long-term sticking around. I don't think he's anywhere near a title contender.
Yeah.
As far as that goes. But, I mean, Alessio Sakara, I think in 2 years, he'll be the main guy headlining some of the smaller local shows.
Right.
You know, I could see him, you know, doing, you know, being the big name on small cards.
Yeah.
But at this point, I think for the big cards, you know, UFC, Elite XC, I mean, I think he'd do okay in Elite XC at this point. But the more dollars they pay fighters, the more competition's going to go that way. So I think he's kind of a lifelong mid-carder.
Yeah, I mean, to me, he's another one I wouldn't mind seeing in the WEC as just a gatekeeper for them, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
think he'd do well. I think
yeah.
I think at 205, he'd give Doug Marshall all he wanted, you know?
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
You know, of course, that would be back at 205. But
right.
Obviously, he wouldn't be Paulo Filho, but... I mean,
no.
he give people some problems. So
yeah, sure. You know, he's always good for at least an entertaining mid card fight,
like you're
mentioning against the mid card guy.
For sure,
he's good for a slugfest. Now, if he were to develop his ground and pound skills, I think he could be something of a bit more of a threat if he was able to take guys down, because he does hit hard, and if he was in a position where it's hard for someone to hit him back, then
exactly.
He'd probably be in a lot better shape.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, he every time I've seen him on the ground, he's been just outclassed. I mean, best example is the Dean Lister fight. And granted, Dean Lister is an Abu Dhabi champion, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, just a lot more decorated athlete as far as the ground game goes. Alessio Sakara has zero. And
yeah.
The minute that fight hit the ground, Sakara was just outclassed by Dean Lister.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's kind of the problem with Alessio Sakara, is that against a guy that has a good chin and hits hard back, he's going to lose those fights. And against guys that have good ground games, he's going to lose those fights. So,
yeah.
You know, he has a puncher's chance in any fight, but if there's resistance, it's probably going to go the other way. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. That Lister fight, that triangle that Lister put on there was a thing of beauty.
It was awesome.
But he could have done it in his sleep. You know?
Yeah. It almost looked like Dean Lister was bored with that fight.
Yeah.
The minute
he
hit the ground, he was just like, okay, well, he's going to make a mistake any second, and I'm going to submit him.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. So.
Oh, yeah, he dove right into the triangle, too.
Yeah.
So. But, okay, now moving backwards again, we've got another middleweight fight. One that, you know, there's the Evan Tanner regional comedy fight. I had a little intrigue going into it. With Evan Tanner making his comeback after a while and all the demons
for sure.
that he's battled over the past couple of years. But to me, the fight was pretty much kind of a foregone conclusion. You know, Okami had the size on him, and he had the, you know, Tanner was going to be rusty, inevitably. So
yeah.
what was your take on this fight, and where does Tanner go now? Is he, you know, do you think he comes back? What do you think he does?
I definitely think he comes back.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and say this first, is that if I'm codependent for 2 years straight and I'm living, you know, on the streets a lot of times, I'm finally getting my life back together. The last person I want to fight is usually Tommy on my first fight back. I don't know what kind of crazy booking that is, but that's putting poor Evan, you know, out to pasture. Yeah, I mean, this guy not only hadn't fought in 2 years, but he had gone through incredibly difficult circumstances on his way back.
Yeah,
and I think they were just, you know, that was old Yeller style, just throwing him out there, taking a shot at him. I felt really bad for Evan Tanner. Emotionally, in my heart, I really wanted him to win that fight against Yushin Okami.
Oh yeah,
just because I think Evan Tanner's a good story. I think it's definitely a story that I wanted to see a happy ending to. And
yeah.
You know, and I think if you read Evan Tanner's blog that he has online, you know, he had a long, actually very inspirational piece about his comeback and how it's just a bump in the road, losing the fight. Although he's disappointed, he feels, you know, feels good because he didn't go back to drinking after the fight. And that's good for him. I say Evan Tanner's back, but you got to put him in against somebody that he might be able to just get comfortable in the octagon again. Yushin Okami was not it.
No.
That's a highly motivated individual to put Evan Tanner out in front of. And this is a guy that's one step away from getting a title shot. And he made Evan Tanner look pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I did catch that blog piece that you were talking about, how he said he wanted to drink after the fight, but he didn't. And he's, you know, how he's done with it for good. And that's great. You know, if you know his story, it's hard not to root for Evan Tanner.
I agree.
I just wish they would have given him a fight like his last one in the UFC, you know, where he
Justin Leavens, that would have been perfect.
Yeah, yeah,
Justin
exactly.
Justin Leavens back, yeah.
Yeah. Where he just comes in and throws a triangle on the guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just somebody that was just not as good. You know, I mean, Yushin Okami is that guy's good. It's really good,
yeah.
You know. And from what I understand, there was four different fighters offered the Tanner fight, and they turned it down. And I understand why they did. It's a no-win fight. If you beat Evan Tanner, you beat somebody that's kind of for lack of a better term, a has-been. He hadn't fought in 2 years, and he had had some problems. I mean, it's a fight that you win, and it's not impressive. And if you lose, it's pretty much tragic. So, I mean,
yeah.
I think that's the situation there. That's nothing to take away from Okami, who I thought was just as beastly as he always is. And
sure.
And if he would have just fought the first two rounds of the Rich Franklin fight, he would have won that one too. So.
Well, certainly a distinct possibility that he could have beaten Franklin. Okami is an interesting fighter in that regard. You know, he kind of sits back and waits. And I'll tell you, if he does that against Silva, you know, Silva kind of is a bit of a counter striker at times, but he can push the pace too. So,
yeah, absolutely.
If he sits back and waits against Silva, he's going to get knocked out pretty quick, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I see that fight being very much like that. I think Okami would be really methodical. And I think Silva would eventually just come and get him. And, I think Okami is about the second best middleweight in the UFC right now, but he's still light years behind Anderson Silva in my estimation.
As should everybody else, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we'll look into the opening fight. We had John Fitch and Chris Wilson. Wilson making his UFC debut here. What did you think about this one?
I got to say, Chris Wilson impressed me. I mean, John Fitch won the fight, but I think that first round, Chris Wilson really showed that he belongs in the UFC. I mean, Fitch has been on such a tear, and Chris Wilson had a hell of a first round, and I think it kind of adjusted Fitch's game plan a little bit. He decided he was going to try to take the fight to the ground, dominate position, and try to squeeze out a decision, and that's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
I think John Fitch definitely took the safe route in this one.
Yeah, for sure.
He was like, this kid's not messing around, and try to get him to the ground and just establish a better position, and that's pretty much what he did.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested to see what Wilson's going to do now, because he acquitted himself really well against pretty much the second best welterweight we're seeing right now behind George St. Pierre.
I agree.
So it's very impressive to me that in his UFC debut, you know, even though he's a pretty experienced guy with some pretty significant wins, relatively speaking, you know, that he would come in and perform like that against Fitch. I hadn't seen much of him before, so the striking to me seemed a little bit unorthodox, but very effective still at the same time.
Yeah, no nerves. Just went out there and did his thing. And I think Fitch was a little surprised by that, is that he wasn't backing away at all. He was taking the fight right to Fitch. And I don't know if Fitch had a bad night or if Wilson's just really that good, but I do know that that's about as lackluster as I've seen Fitch. In a UFC run. So,
I think that fight spoke a little bit, and I mentioned this in my column on Monday. I have to quote myself, but it speaks a little bit to how the UFC sets up their title fights, because Fitch knows at this point, before this fight, that he's a win away from a title shot, or at least potentially. So what does he do? You know, he doesn't want to go out there, push the pace, and then get knocked out by this, you know, newcomer, you know, a guy that probably he didn't know the style very well. And he goes in there, and this guy's pushing the pace, and what's he going to do? Is he going to stand with him? Well, no, he's not going to stand with him. He's going to take him down and grind it out, like you said.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think Fitch realized that, you know what, I'm a step away here. Don't take any chances. So
yeah, and so instead of doing it like that, it seems to me it would be more effective if you got two guys in there, like, say, Fitch and Carl Parisian, that, you know, they're both one step away from a title shot, and they have to go out and win the fight.
People forget about Parisian.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy should have had his title shot a long time ago, and unfortunately got hurt, and then you saw Joe Riggs take a spot, and I think most of us remember the fiasco of Riggs not making weight and then getting Kimura'd very early in that fight.
Yep.
But, I mean, Carol Parisian's one of the top guys at 170, and people seem to forget that.
Definitely.
And I think if you put him in with Fitch, you got two guys that are fighting for something. And I think you see an entertaining fight. So that's just my opinion of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to say nothing to the fact that Fitch and Parisian are both really entertaining fighters when they're on their game.
Exactly.
You know, give them something to fight for in addition to all that. And I think that's a heck of a fight.
Yeah. Chris Wilson's another guy that could give Condit some problems in the WEC.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. To get him down to the WC fighting Condit, or get him, you know, fighting Diego Sanchez or something. I want to see this guy again.
Exactly.
Speaking of Sanchez, I don't know, did you happen to catch some of the preliminaries?
I did. I did the UFC on demand thing. I wanted to see Arlovski's fight, and I wanted to see Sanchez's fight. And I thought Sanchez looked as good as we've seen him in a long time. It was a throwback fight in my view.
Yeah, absolutely.
He looked like he did fresh out of the Ultimate Fighter house, just imposing his will. And I think that's something we kind of lost along the way with Diego. I think he became – I think he started thinking he was a stand-up fighter. And I think he got shown, especially in the Koscheck fight, which Koscheck by no view would be considered a stand-up fighter. And he really lost the stand-up battle to Koscheck in that fight.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think he came out and imposed as well in this fight. He looked like the Diego Sanchez of old. So,
yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised to hear him make some noise in 2008. So.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It was a throwback fight because it was the old crazy Diego Sanchez that we saw earlier.
Yeah.
They just came out and he just ran right over David Bilkinen or whatever his name was.
Bilkinen.
Yeah.
He didn't have anything with Diego. So.
Yeah.
But then, I checked out the Arlovski fight as well, and Arlovski had kind of a weird first round where Jake O'Brien had a good game plan. He just was going to come in, and he was going to try to take Arlovski down and establish position, and it worked in the first round, and it didn't work in the second round. And Arlovski ended up getting mount and having his way. So.
Yeah, and I think now we saw that Arlovski, he had O'Brien in position for a guillotine a few times, and Joe Rogan was actually mentioning it in the commentary. Wondering why he wasn't going for, you know, trying to cinch up that guillotine. And I heard later in an interview that Arlovski said he knew about the neck injury that O'Brien had and they didn't want to aggravate the neck injury. And I thought it was funny, you know, you don't really hear that a lot out of fighters.
That's an interesting way of looking at that situation. I know a lot of people that have said, oh, he has a neck injury, I'm going to really try to get him a guillotine.
Yeah, exactly.
That would have been a more common, assumption as far as most fighters would go. So,
yeah,
well, that's one thing I didn't know about Arlovski is that he's a humanitarian, apparently.
Oh, absolutely.
So, there you go. Didn't want to hurt him.
Pitbull with a heart of gold. Right?
Yeah, there you go. There's a TV movie somewhere. So,
yeah.
Hadn't heard that. So that's funny. That's very funny.
Yeah, it was the same situation with the ground and pound because really, you know, he was in position to do a lot of damage to O'Brien, but he didn't. You know, he didn't really pour it on like he could have.
Yeah, in retrospect, now that I have that information, he might have been pulling back a little bit. That's weird. Lacking killer instinct a little bit.
Yeah, kind of an interesting tidbit there for Arlovski.
Maybe Dana knows more about Andre than we did, you know.
You know?
maybe Dana's right. I don't know. So, that's interesting.
Yeah, but definitely interested to see what happens with Arlovski next. You know, apparently his contract runs out in May as far as timeline goes, so we'll have to see I mean, in my estimation, the UFC should definitely look at bringing him back and give him a title shot. I don't think there's anyone else that's really even deserving of one right now. But
yeah, honestly, at this point, I don't see him bringing him back. I just, even though he's probably the second most talented heavyweight in the UFC, I think there's something we don't know going on between Arlovski's camp and Dana White. I think.
Yeah.
I mean, just look. I mean, he was relegated to the undercard against Jake O'Brien. If you look, Arlovski made $170,000 for his fight. And, that's pretty much, other than the main event, that's the top dollar amount that they got paid. So.
Yeah. Well, we all know how Dana White feels about crazy Russians.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it's one of those things where, if you've been following along with the Fedor Red Devil situation, you know that Dana White apparently isn't rocking the Eastern Bloc. So.
Right. Good. Well, I guess that'll wrap up our UFC 82 discussion. Solid event in my book.
Yeah, I liked
overall.
It.
Yeah.
I thought it was $45 well spent.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's $5 more than I wanted to spend, but...
Isn't it always?
I clicked on my cable box, and I was like, oh, they're up in the ante. So
yeah,
it's
good. Well, well, for that, we'll
$45 on worse things. So
what's that?
I've wasted $45 on worse things. So
yeah,
that was a fairly entertaining event. So
that's for sure. Well, let's wrap up part one there as far as the podcast goes, and then we'll go into part two here shortly. We'll post this on Friday. We're going to go into the Elite XC CBS deal. We'll talk a little bit about World Victory Road, even though we haven't even seen it. Maybe get into a little bit about Ken Shamrock fighting in cage raid this weekend. And until then, this is Sean Ennis for John Taylor. Thanks for listening.